For the second week in a row, we're going to veer from our normal topic. Last week it was because of the patira of another gadol in the Hasidic world, Rav Vosner, a very important posek. And this week, for two reasons. First, because of the tremendous loss in the modern Orthodox community of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, who was nifter this week. And also because today was Yom HaAtzmaut, even though tonight already, now it's Hey Iyar, so I thought we would discuss something relating to Eretz Yisrael, especially since we lost one of the great Zionist Gedolim of our time. So I thought it would be Kedai to talk about Rav Lichtenstein's Torah relating to Eretz Yisrael. Now let me be very clear from the outset. You will hear probably, if you even look a little bit online, or I'm sure in many shuls, many hespedim for Rav Lichtenstein, people who will talk about the tzidkus, the gadlus, the chasidus, the diktuk ba'alacha, the hasmada, everything, you know, the brain, the commitment of Rav Lichtenstein. And most of those speeches will start with the disclaimer, I'm not really ready to be masvid Rav Lichtenstein, but, you know, if his talmidim and his children aren't going to do it, who's going to do it? So obviously they have the responsibility to be masvid. I never learned by Rav Lichtenstein. I never even spoke to Rav Lichtenstein. I met him a couple of times, but I was too scared to speak. So I never really had any conversation with him. And it wouldn't even be shaykh for me to try to give a hespes. That's not what this is. I'm not going to talk about, you know, what he meant and what he was, because I don't have any direct connection. I have a lot of indirect connection. I certainly on Monday morning, I normally wake up at about 5 in the morning to prepare the Daf Yomi, and I go to sleep pretty early also. So a lot of times when I wake up, my inbox is already full of shilas from the night before that I missed. So the first thing I do is after I say Berachas HaTorah is I check my email. How many of you have to say Berachas HaTorah before you check your email? It's a good. So I have to say Berachas HaTorah before I check my email. And I saw right away that I had a message at 5 o'clock in the morning, Nafla Teres Roshenu, and I realized something must have happened. I clicked on and I saw that it must have been just not long after, not much before that, that he had passed away. And I found myself crying, tears streaming down my face, and I was audibly crying. I was surprised I didn't wake up my children, and then I was like confused. Why am I crying? I didn't even know the man. I never learned by him. I never had any real direct connection. What exactly am I crying about? And I like to believe that somewhere deep down that my neshama has some sort of appreciation for godless and for kedusha and for the loss that the world experienced of that godless and kedusha. But it goes beyond that. It's also, I have many close family members who are close talmidim and close friends who are a close Talmidim of Rav Lichtenstein. My father-in-law is a Talmud of Rav Lichtenstein. My brother-in-law is a Talmud of Rav Lichtenstein. My uncle is Rav Lichtenstein's best friend on this earth. My uncle flew to Eretz Yisrael for the Shiva. His wife didn't want him there for the Levaya. She thought he would fall apart if he was there for the Levaya, so they went right after the Levaya. So maybe that's what it was. But I can't really give a hesped, and that's not my goal over here. So I wanted to discuss Rav Lichtenstein's, to share some of Rav Lichtenstein's Torah relating to Eretz Yisrael, some of his ideas relating to Eretz Yisrael. And it's important because, as I mentioned, he was a great Zionist. I don't know how many of you know the history of his life a little bit, but he essentially was a super duper genius from a very early age, and he was Omid the Gedula, and it was evident to everybody that he was Omid the Gedula. You know, he learned in Chaim Berlin for high school, and he became a close Talmud of, he was a Talmud of Rav Huttner, and he certainly kept that relationship for a while after he left Chaim Berlin, and he was very clear that he was Omid the Gedula. He went to Yeshiva University, and he became the son-in-law of the Rav Zichrono Livracha, and then of course he went to Harvard and earned a PhD as the youngest, I think, to this day, the youngest person awarded a PhD in English literature in Harvard University. So it wasn't like Stam, your average Joe walking around with a PhD from Harvard. He was fairly accomplished in the secular world as well. And he represented Torah Umada, which is the motto of the yeshiva that he was that he was teaching in, and he was the son-in-law of the Rosh Yeshiva, and he was a super-duper genius, and he was clearly, even though they call a lot of people Rosh Yeshiva in that yeshiva, it was clear that he was being groomed to be the one to replace his father-in-law ultimately. I mean, that was the clear trajectory of where his life was going. He was a Rosh Kollel already, he was appointed as Rosh Kollel, and I think about it, he was my age. He was younger than me. He was when he was Rosh Kollel. He was. I'm not such an old guy. The gray and the beard may make me look old. I'm not such an old guy. He was a very, very young person, but he was a super duper genius, and he had accomplished a great deal. And the malchus was going to be given to him, as much of a malchus as it is. The crown of the father of modern Orthodox Judaism in North America was going to be given to him, and it was clear that it was going to be given to him. And he gave it up because there was a Rosh Yeshiva on the West Bank who had like a 2-year-old yeshiva that called him up and said, hey, how would you like to come and be a Rosh Yeshiva? Of what? Of a mountaintop on the West Bank where there's maybe a dozen guys and they're sleeping in whatever the Jordanians left behind, you know, a couple of years earlier. And for what? What's he giving up already? And he said, so what was his response? I don't want to be a Rosh Yeshiva. You're already a Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Amital. I'll come and I'll be a Rebbe and I'll teach. Rav Amital says, what a joke. I'm going to be a Rosh Yeshiva if Rav Lichtenstein is here. You know, it's so incongruous. Rav Lichtenstein was heads and shoulders above everybody else. It wasn't Shaykh that he wouldn't be the Rosh Yeshiva. So they fought back and forth until they finally agreed that they'll be co-Rosh Yeshiva. And he went to this little mountaintop on the West Bank where there was nothing. There was nothing going on. And it's not like he left, you know, a little shteller. He left being the leader of modern Orthodoxy in all of America. I mean, there's no other way to say it. And he went and he built up a yeshiva, a community around that yeshiva, and it was amazing that one of the Hasbeidim, they pointed out that, you know, people would come to the institution that he built to learn Tanakh and to receive training and teaching and everything. That was all built. Gush wasn't a place that had 400 Talmidim when he went there, and it was quite risky, and it was a tremendous... And his father-in-law didn't want him to go. I don't think it's a state secret that his father-in-law didn't want him to go. Soloveitchik didn't want him to go. Thought he was giving up too much, and he was going to be mashpia so much more in America than he would be in Eretz Yisrael. So I don't know if there was a greater act of Mesiras Nefesh for the dream of settling the land of Israel than what he did. I don't know what it is. You know, it was a tremendous Mesiras Nefesh at the time, and was really giving up his whole career. It turned out that he developed quite a career there, but it was far from obvious that that's what was going to happen. So I thought that being that Lichtenstein was nifter this week and we're still within the Shiva, and being that tonight now is Hey Iyar, even though we never actually celebrate Yom HaTzmon and Hey Iyar, it's one of those things. But tonight is Hey Iyar. I thought it would be appropriate to talk about Rav Lichtenstein's Torah relating to Eretz Yisrael. But here's my suffix. Here's what I'm not sure about. Should we talk hashkafa or should we talk halacha / lamdas? Okay, then maybe a show of hands. All those who would prefer more of an emphasis, let's say, on the hashkafic side of his approach to Eretz Yisrael? All those who would prefer halacha / lamdas side of Eretz Yisrael? Okay, so it seems hashkafa mostly wins, so maybe we'll do a little bit of halacha lamdas at the end, but we'll do hashkafa. As ill-equipped as I am to present Rav Lichtenstein's lamdas, which I am very ill-equipped to present Rav Lichtenstein's lamdas, being that every share I ever sat in that he gave, I didn't understand it. The lamdas was always beyond me. It's like, wait, how many possibilities are there for that halacha? 18? You know, I don't know if you've ever heard shiurim from him. He'd start with a halacha and be like, so is that A or B? And if it's B, is it C or D? And if it's D, is it E or F? And he'd just like draw these, and we'd be like, okay, so there are 18 possibilities. And then he'd start closing them off, but if you close that one off, that one might still be open. But then that one, like, it was very, very challenging for me. I was never really, and it was hard to hear him, certainly in his later decades. He didn't speak clearly, so it was very difficult just to make out the words. But at least lamdas is my comfort zone. So hashkafa is a little bit less so. If you ever want to find a good sefer of Rav Lichtenstein's lamdas, a friend of mine, Mr. Howie Balter, he's probably a rabbi also, must have smicha. Howie Bolter's quite a Talmud Chacham. He gave me this sefer called Minchas Aviv, Rav Lichtenstein's Shiurim in Shas, Sugyos in Shas. And the great thing about what they did in Gush is that if you ever have difficulty with the Hebrew, the Tiv Haofi, with the modern Hebrew that they use instead of the more classical rabbinic Hebrew, they have pretty much every shiur in here translated on the VBM on the website. So you could find pretty much everything here in English. But as difficult as it would be to give over his lamdas, to give over his hashkafa in a proper way, I'm even less equipped. But I'll give it a shot. What I'm going to try to present is three different sichot that Rav Lichtenstein presented on Yom HaTzmut. These were given on Yom HaTzmut, and it's important to just take note of one thing before we see any of them, and that is that if you speak to anyone who ever heard Rav Lichtenstein or who knew him, they always say, I think one of the Talmidim even called his hesped, the rabbi with two hands. Why is he the rabbi with two hands? Because no matter what you asked him, it was always, on the one hand, you could say this, but on the other hand, everything was nuanced. There was no such thing as black and white. There was nothing that was so... He was so gecheshbent. He was so clearly thought out that there's nothing that's like, oh, it's good, it's perfect, it's great, rah rah. You would always see the flaws in something, the advantages of something, something that we would look at and say, well, that's terrible. He would say, yes, but. Something that we would look at and say, well, that's great. He would say, yes, but there is this room for improvement, that room for improvement. So as a Zionist, he was no different. It is important to point out, Rav Willig pointed out in his hesped, which I wasn't expecting to think that Rabbi Willig's hesped of Rav Lichtenstein would be the best hesped I would hear, just because I thought, maybe the Talmidim would do it, but Rabbi Willig's hesped was fantastic. I thought he gave a hesped to Rabbi Sachs's shul, I think it was. I listened online. It was Rabbi Yonason Sachs, Rabbi Willig, and Rabbi Cohn. I don't know Rabbi Cohn real good. So I think he's a Rabbi Pesach, who's a Talmud of Rabbi Lichtenstein. And they gave hesped in Rabbi Sachs's shul, and Rabbi Willig's hesped was off the charts. It was absolutely phenomenal. One of the things he pointed out was that 99% of the time, Rabbi Lichtenstein was very nuanced, and there were two sides to the issue, and he would cheshbon both sides. But you have to pay attention to that 1% of the time where there was no equivocation, there was absolute, there was decisiveness. And Rabbi Willig said it was by the big three. He cited one incident of Gilui Arayos, one incident of Shlichus Damim, and one incident of Avodah Zarah, where Rav Lichtenstein was particularly decisive. He said certainly the Gilui Arayos was a much publicized case of a prominent Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael who was accused of misbehaving with the boys in the yeshiva, and Rav Lichtenstein put his neck on the line to get that person out of chinuch, and tried to do it in a private way, but the person fought back, and he did it in a very public way, and he got a bashing for it, for doing it, but there was no equivocation when it came to something like that. In the Shvichas Damim was when I was learning in Yeshivat Keren Biavne, one of the upperclassmen who had just recently graduated or left the yeshiva murdered the prime minister that year, murdered Yitzhak Rabin that year. So there was... Oh no, that wasn't the case that he gave. That happened to be true, but that wasn't the case that he gave. The case that he gave was when Baruch Goldstein went into the mosque and killed all those people, and there was a lot of talk about, well, he was right, he did it, and Rav Lichtenstein said, no, this is not the way a Jew behaves, this is not what we do, and this is not, and he was unequivocal about that. And Rabbi Willig cited one other case of Avodah Zarah, where someone, I don't know what the case was, he said he was at an Orthodox forum meeting once, and someone started saying some sort of hashkafa that was a little bit not really something we'd be comfortable with. And the person was saying, based on what Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said about X, we can conclude Y. And Rav Lichtenstein got up and said, if Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach were here, he would tear Kriya listening to that. Unequivocal. So there were certain things that he didn't equivocate about. But most things that a thoughtful person would struggle with, he was honest enough to and thoughtful enough and contemplated enough to say that there are some great things here and there are some not such great things here, and we need to break it down. And that's what emerges from a lot of what he talks about when he deals with the state of Israel, which is somewhat comforting, because the state of Israel and the way we experience it is a little bit different than I guess we ever expected to experience it in history. Historically, the Jewish people always expected, you know, we're going to go on the wings of eagles and Mashiach is going to come and everything's going to be fine, and we're going to go straight from, you know, suffering persecution to having the Beis HaMikdash come down from Shemayim, and that's it. That's going to be Geula. Ein Tzvai Drei, we're done, and everything's going to be happy. And as it turns out, HaKadosh Baruch Hu apparently has a different plan, where things are going to go two steps forward, one step back, and there's going to be struggle, and there's going to be, and it's not always going to be easy, and there's going to be parts where we're going to be successful and where we're not going to be successful, and things take time, as it turns out. So that sense of nuance emerges in all three of these sichot that I'm going to share with you. Now, I didn't hear these sichot; I just, you know, read them on Gush's website on the VBM. But I think each one has a critical message. And this is a summary of what I read on VBM, and you can read it for yourself for the more complete picture. And we're going to go in chronological order, not chronological order of the years that he said them, but chronological order of what he was describing. So first, we start with the very beginning. And I may ad-lib a little bit, so don't assume that everything that I'm saying is necessarily directly from Lev Lichtenstein, and I apologize in advance if I kolamosif goreya, if anything I add takes away from his Torah. But he starts with the original person in Tanakh to make the trek, to try to go to Eretz Yisrael. You know, it starts really, I always say, it starts in Parshas Lech Lecha and doesn't stop till the end of Chumash, where the Chumash focuses on Eretz Yisrael. But it's not really that it starts in Parshas Lech Lecha, it really starts at the end of Parshas Noach. Avram starts his journey already at the end of Parshas Noach. The Rav Shechter used to tell us that they asked Rav Kook once, why is it that you're so obsessed with Eretz Yisrael? It's always Eretz Yisrael this, Eretz Yisrael that. You know, you have such a focus, such an emphasis in Eretz Yisrael. And Rav Kook said, I don't understand what you're talking about. I just try to mold my personality on the Torah. And if the Torah emphasizes something, so I try to emphasize that in my personality. And if the Torah de-emphasizes something, so I de-emphasize that in my personality. He just opened the Chumash from Parshas Lech Lecha until the very end, and really from the end of Parshas Noach till the very end. Every single parsha is about Eretz Yisrael, about the mitzvahs of Tlius Baretz, the dream to go to Eretz Yisrael. It's all Eretz Yisrael. So if I'm going to emphasize that, of course I'm going to emphasize that in my personality, because I want my personality to reflect the Torah, and that's a very reasonable thing. But it all starts at the end of Parshas Noach, and Avram Avinu goes at the end of Parshas Noach on his own free will. He decides that he's going to make Aliyah. He's going to go to Eretz Canaan, and he left Ur Kasdim and to go to Eretz Canaan, and he came to Haran, and he stayed there for a bit. And then at the beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha, it says that Avram was commanded by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Lech Lecha Me'artzecha. All of a sudden, it wasn't him going on his own free will. Now HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Lech Lecha Me'artzecha, Me'latchem Beis Avicha, El Eretz Asher Arecha, that you should go to the land that I'm going to show you. And the Ramban at the end of Parshas Noach explains the duality of what's going on over here, that there's a double message over here in Avram's trip, because there was a double purpose, a dual purpose in Avram's trip. You see, when he first left, he left from the land of the Kasdim because he was afraid of the king. He was afraid of what was going to happen to him there. Essentially, the very first Jew to flee persecution was Avram Avinu. He was fleeing persecution. So Eretz Yisrael was not about where he was going to, it was about what he was escaping from. It wasn't about a vision of grandeur, of Kedusha, or anything else in Eretz Yisrael originally at the end of Parshas Noach. It was about getting out of the place that is extremely dangerous. And this is very important in life in general. I had a Talmud that was asking me recently, he's an 11th grader and he wanted to know, he was thinking about going to Eretz Yisrael next year instead of waiting another year. And I asked him a couple of questions, but the one major question I asked him, are you running away from something or are you going to something? And those are very different things. Because if you're running away from something, then the place you're going to might not be the right place. meaning maybe you should, maybe there is something to run away from, but maybe it should be somewhere else, or maybe it doesn't really matter where it is. But if you're going to something, if you have a positive goal that you're aspiring to, that you're looking to, so that gives a whole different picture. So originally, it was Avram running away. He was running away from Or Kasdim, and he wanted to go to a place where the language, the Ramban explains, and the end of Parshas Noach, he wanted to go to a place where the language was different, where it wasn't Lashon Hara, where they spoke a totally different language, so he was going to go to Eretz Canaan. So it began in the same way, Rav Lichtenstein said, in a certain sense, as Herzl Zionist movement began, where there's persecution. Jews are not really made to be comfortable wherever they are, and certainly the Holocaust was a major motivation for the founding of the State of Israel. That, you know, as I'm sure most of you probably saw Bibi Netanyahu's speech on the floor of Congress a few weeks ago, and there was a certain sense of pride that many people felt when he said, those, I don't remember if this is an exact quote, but when he said, the days where the Jewish people will stand idly by in the face of the enemies who threaten to destroy us and to wipe us out, those days are over. And we felt, yeah, those days are over. Now we have our own country, we have our own place where we are safe, where we can be protected, where someone will look out for us. But we should realize that's the first type of movement. That's the Parshas Noach, Avram Avinu. That's Eretz Yisrael's value as a place where we can escape persecution, where we can flee to because of what we're running away from. But while Avraham is on the move, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him that you should do exactly what you're planning on doing. Go to Eretz Canaan, but now you're going with an imperative. You're going with an imperative of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and here Hashem's plan and Avraham's plan intersect with each other, but Hashem's plan is a much more meaningful and deep plan for Avram Avinu. You're going to go to Eretz Yisrael not because you're just running away from something, but because you're going to actualize the will of the Ribbono Shel Olam on an individual level, on a national level. You're going to experience a living that you haven't experienced before. And Rav Lichtenstein connected this to his father-in-law's idea, to Rav Soloveitchik's idea of the bris, the covenant of fate, and the covenant of destiny, that the Jewish people have a certain fate, that which comes our way and we have to deal with throughout history, and we also have a destiny, a goal, a dream, a vision. And Avram Avinu also had that. He had that fate. The fate would be the end of Parshas Noach, Avram Avinu, that he's escaping that persecution that seems to find the Jew wherever the Jew goes. But then he also had the destiny. He had somewhere that he had to go in order to fully appreciate his relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And a lot of times, when you think about the Medina, Rav Lichtenstein points out, a lot of people criticize the State of Israel, especially in the religious community, that it lacks a certain spirituality, a certain morality to it. You know, Rav Shechter always likes to point out that people say, how could the Medina have any significance? It's run by Rishayim, it's run by... So Rav Shechter always points out, you know, if you read the Nevi'im, it wasn't always, the Malchei Yisrael weren't always the biggest tzaddikim. They were like, Ovdei Avodah Zarah left and right. You know, they still had a din. Shabbat always says that in a different context. He always says that in the context of viewing Medinat Yisrael as we have it, as Reisha Smichas Gulasenu, as the beginning of the Geula process. And his raya is the Gemara in Sanhedrin, that it says that the Geula process has three steps. It's Lahamid Lahem Melech, Lahachrizara Shalamalek, and Livnos Lahem Beis HaBechira. So the first step of Geula is Lahamid Lahem Melech. So he always says, so we were Mamun HaMelech, we have a Malchus, we have a government. So that's the first step of Geula. So when people tell you, what do you mean? That's not a real Jewish government. That's a government that is full of Rishayim. So he always says, yeah, there are plenty of Jewish governments that are full of Rishayim. And this one's better than most. There's no government, there's no entity that did more to support Torah in terms of financial assistance to Torah in the history of humanity, in the history of the Jewish people, than the State of Israel does every single year in terms of the hundreds of millions of dollars that it gives to support Torah, even with all the cuts, with all the threatened cuts and what actually happened, what didn't actually happen in terms of those cuts, but even with all the threats, it's still giving more money to support Torah than anybody ever in the history of all of humanity. So it's we could tone down the rhetoric in terms of just how bad the Rishayim are that are running the country, but one could certainly argue, and there's certainly a criticism, that it lacks a certain moral vision, and that in a sense it runs like any other country would run, as opposed to a country that has a great vision. It's become a country of refugees, of a political asylum, of a place to run away, where you can run away from whatever it is that you're running away from. And that is the sense of never again. And that alone is a legitimate goal, but it's really only half a goal. And that's where secular Zionism suffers a lot. Secular Zionism ends there. Meaning the idea is, like the Prime Minister said, never again, we will not be stand idly by, never again, we're not going to, are we going to be left to be persecuted by others without anyone standing up for us. But it ends there. There's no grander goal of a destiny of the Jewish people, of a Torah Eretz, of a Torah Yisrael, in Eretz Yisrael, with an Am Yisrael, with a goal for the future, for a Mashiach, and for a Beis HaMikdash, and for... So it sort of ends there. And part of the beauty of being a religious Jew is that we have this extra aspiration to achieve certain goals Dafka in that land, because the first goal could be in anywhere that Jewish people decide to get together. And some, you know, if they would have decided, if the United Nations would have decided in 1948 to give us some other land other than the land of our forefathers, that first goal could have been met, and some of the early Zionists would have been perfectly happy with that. It wasn't really about a vision of where the Jewish people are going, but our vision is so much greater than that. It's the vision of Lech Lecha, to think about the land of Israel as a very special place, as Yerusha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that has to penetrate very deeply into our psyche. And Rav Lichtenstein suggests that he believes that even the secular Zionists, when it came down to it, somewhere deep down, their hearts throbbed with a certain sense of fulfillment of a prophetic vision of the Nevi'im, that the Pintel Yid in there somewhere did feel that there is more than just whatever we're running away from and whatever it is that we're escaping from. But even if you don't want to accept that, he said, even if the builders of Israel viewed the land totally as the covenant of fate, as the Parshas Noach Avram Avinu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu adds the covenant of destiny, and we have to grab onto that and use the covenant of fate as a stepping stone to the covenant of destiny. And that should be part of our mission in Eretz Yisrael. So that's the first sicha, a very basic summary of the first sicha, of Avram Avinu's mission and the extra meaning his mission took on halfway through. And it's something that we see. You know, it's something that when we look at what's being accomplished, yes, the Prime Minister is correct. We escaped certain, or we now feel that we have someone to protect us, that we have somewhere where a Jew is always going to be welcome, where a Jew is never going to be told, we don't want you here. But we also see so much more than that. We see a place where, built into the culture, there is Kedusha. It's built into the very culture of the land. You know, Rabbi Kenny Hain once remarked that he was in Eretz Yisrael once, and he was in a hotel, and he turned on the television in his hotel room just to work on his Hebrew for the Hebrew subtitles, to watch American programming and read the Hebrew subtitles. So he said that it was an episode of MacGyver. Now, you guys are probably a little young for MacGyver, but I don't know, you've heard of Jack Bauer in 24? So before that, there was MacGyver. So that was he was like the guy who did things that were like that no human being could ever do. So anyway, he was watching. I'm not going to get into all the drush about MacGyver, but he was watching an episode of MacGyver, and he said that the someone said in the show, "What does that have to do with anything?" And the subtitle read, "Ma'inyan Shmita Eitzel Har Sinai," and he said, "Ah, I'm in Eretz Yisrael. This is that the Kedusha permeates the." The subtitles of MacGyver. But Rav Lichtenstein's second sicha, and I don't know if we can get to all three, but the second sicha that he gave on Yom HaTzmud didn't deal with Avram Avinu, but it dealt with Yaakov Avinu. That Yaakov Avinu described that he went to the Eretz Megurei Aviv and Eretz Kena'an. And Rav Lichtenstein so brilliantly pointed out that those are two different things for us, while they were the same for Yaakov. I mean, when Yaakov Avinu in Parshas Vayeshev goes back to Eretz Yisrael, he's going back to Eretz Yisrael, which is also Eretz Megurei Aviv. And what Rav Lichtenstein aims for in this sicha is to speak to Bnei Chutz La'aretz, who are learning in Eretz Yisrael, or who have experienced learning in Eretz Yisrael, and who struggle with, where do I really belong? And if you don't struggle with it, that's its own issue. That's also a problem. We should struggle with, where do I really belong? Do I really have reason to be here as opposed to being in Eretz Yisrael? And obviously, given the man that was presenting this and what he gave up to be there, it means a little bit more. And he pointed out that Yaakov Avinu was going for two reasons. It was the land of his father, it was his family's home, and it was Eretz Canaan. It was the chosen land. It was the Eretz Yisrael. Now, that's significant because the Rashbam points out that both of those were goals. He wanted to be near. He was away for 20 years, so he wanted to be near his father. He wanted to make up for all those years that he was away from his aging and sick father, to be able to get whatever he can from his father while his father was still around. But he also... And that also entailed, Rav Lichtenstein points out, a certain sense of tradition, of continuity, a sense of that this is where I'm rooted, this is where I belong, because it's where my family is from. But that's all on the family level. That's all in Megurei Aviv. So on the family level, it's about the actual people being with his father, and it's also about a sense of continuity, that this is where my family belongs. You know, sometimes you go back to your hometown, if you're not from around here, you go, there's just like a certain comfort level. It's like, oh, that store that I always go to, and you just feel like, you know, this is, it's home. It just feels like there's a sense of belonging, a sense of permanence in your hometown. But there was the second level, and that was Eretz Kena'an. Because if his parents would have lived, as Rav Lichtenstein said, in Paris or Los Angeles, maybe not Paris today, but you know, if they would have lived in any other place, he could have had that same sense of longing for his father, the same sense of belonging in that town. But there was something else that was drawing Yaakov back, and that was the unique Kedushas Eretz Yisrael. See, Yaakov, unlike Yitzchak, had to be forced away from the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. So it wasn't just, when it came time to really settle, to really put his roots down, he wanted to be careful that that not happen in Chutz La'aretz, that that finally happened in Eretz Yisrael, because he had a real relationship with Eretz Yisrael, and because of the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. So he had two independently valid reasons that he dafka wanted to be in Eretz Yisrael. But for us, Rav Lichtenstein pointed out, very often it doesn't quite work that way. You see, our Eretz Megurei Aviv is very often not Eretz Kena'an. We grew up in America. Our families are in America. When a person decides to make Aliyah nowadays, very often what that means is he's leaving his family behind. He's leaving his parents, he's leaving his in-laws, his wife is leaving her parents, so he's leaving something behind, and there is that draw of the comforts of home, and that creates a tension, and that's okay. That should create a tension. If a person leaves without ever thinking once how that's going to affect his parents, that's not okay. It's okay to have tension in our life. That's part of, I don't know much about Rav Lichtenstein's hashkafa, but one of the basic tenets of his hashkafa seems to be that tension is desirable. It's okay. It's not something we have to run away from. It's often a sign of a healthy outlook when there's a certain amount of tension, when there's things pulling us in both directions. I remember when I was in Rav Shachter Shir, he once quoted the Chachmas Adam. Chachmas Adam says that it's a unique shita, that if your parents want you to stay in America, not in America, he says in Chutz La'aretz, and you want to go to Eretz Yisrael. So most poskim say you go to Eretz Yisrael because parents can't tell you not to do a mitzvah. Chachmas Adam shita is that you stay in Chutz La'aretz. If your parents say they need you there to be mechabed them. So I remember in Shir, someone raised their hand and said, Rabbi, what if you have 10 children I'm sorry, your parents have 10 children, and all of the others can take care of your parents. They'll be fine. They're all staying here in Chutz Lars. What would he say then? Then can you go to Eretz Yisrael? So Rav Shachter said, I have 9 children, and I love every single one of them. Miss Tama, when you have 10, it's different. I still have no idea what he meant by that, but it was one of those moments that I'll never forget. So we have this actual dilemma where we have our parents in one place, and a native-born Israeli tend to think that the reason there's so little aliyah from Chutz Laaretz is because we enjoy driving nice cars, and we don't want to drive a Fiat or whatever it is that they're driving. No offense to Fiat, but whatever bicycle with a tiny engine they have that can't get you up the hill, or because we enjoy living in with a lawn and in sprawling houses or whatever, and people, it's a very cynical view. But really, what holds a lot of people back when push comes to shove, when it comes down to it, is not so much the creature comforts and the physical comforts of Chutz Laaretz, because very often you can get many of those in Eretz Yisrael, and we're willing to sacrifice some of that. But very often it actually is the family pull. It is the fact of Meguri Aviv, of having to break with your family. However, realizing that is a significant step for one to leave their family, at the very least, someone who had the zuchus of learning in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Lichtenstein said, should have a sense of kedushas haaretz and of connectedness to the land. I remember when I never actually sent an application, but when I took a bechina for Yeshiva Keren B'Yavne, it's the only bechina I took. I don't know how I got in without an application. It's still a mystery. But when I took a bechina for Yeshiva at Keren B'Yavne, Rav Blachman challenged me, and he said, he likes to argue a little bit. So he said, why do you want to go to Eretz Yisrael for the year? So I thought that was like a stupid question. What do you mean? That's what you do after high school. And, so I said, I want to learn Torah. I want to learn, all day long, and I want without any distractions and without anything bothering me. So he said, I have a great idea. Go to Baltimore, or go to some base medrash in Borough Park somewhere, and there won't be any distractions. Just don't go to college and go learn somewhere. So I said, no, but I want to experience Kedushas Haaretz. And he said, you have no idea what that means. And he was right. I didn't know what that, but that was the point. The point was that I was supposed to come to appreciate what that means. And Rav Lichtenstein said, it's very sad when people go, and you see this happen all the time, that people will go for a year, two, three, learning Eretz Yisrael, and learning beautifully, and that's great, and that's really important, that they're learning beautifully, but they come back without any sense of Eretz Yisrael being something special, being a place that's inherently holy. And that's unfortunate. That shouldn't happen. Learning in Eretz Yisrael is not something that should be able to be done in a Beis Medrash in Borough Park or in Baltimore. That's inconceivable in Rav Lichtenstein's view, that a person is going to go learn in Eretz Yisrael and come back feeling like it's just another place. And even if later on in life we find that we have valid reasons that we need to be in Chutz Laaretz. And sometimes we do. We really find that we have valid reasons that we need to be in Chutz Laaretz, even when opportunities come up in Eretz Yisrael. And you'd be surprised, even in Chinuch sometimes, opportunities come up in Eretz Yisrael that really give you a cause, to reflect and to think, wait a second, what am I doing here? Do I really need to be here? I always said to myself when I was learning in yeshiva, well, I thought I was going to be a lawyer. I never thought I was going to be a rebbe. But I always said, if there would be a case where I would be a rebbe, and I was offered a job teaching in like one of the post high school yeshivas in Israel, that's a no-brainer. That's like the ideal. That's the ideal world where you're teaching motivated students right there. It's a no-brainer. But life is complicated, and things aren't always a no-brainer, and things. But at the very least, it should be a struggle. At the very least, we should feel that there's some unfulfilled dream in not being in Eretz Yisrael. At the very least, we should feel that. And he tells the story of how his first visit to Eretz Yisrael is 1962, 29 years old, his first visit to Eretz Yisrael. And he met with Rav Huttner, who was also had a tremendous attachment to Eretz Yisrael. And he spoke to Rav Huttner about what it was like to be there. And Rav Huttner asked him, "Nu, what were your impressions? What did you feel when you were in Eretz Yisrael?" And he told Rav Huttner, Jewish life. There's a sense of community there. Everyone's a brother. Everyone's, certainly on Yom HaZikaron you feel that everyone knows somebody and feels like there's a certain sense of togetherness, a certain sense of community that everyone's in this together. And he said, yeah, we felt that way in Eastern Europe also. But what did you feel about Eretz Yisrael? And he said, well, also like the application of halacha in Israel is phenomenal in terms of the Batei Din, have the jurisdiction over not just Dine Mamun, not just Isra Heter, but Dine Mamun, and all other areas of halacha. And Rav Huttner said, yeah, we had that in Eastern Europe also. What did you feel in Eretz Yisrael? And he said that Rav Huttner finally said to him, why haven't you mentioned the uniqueness of being in Eretz Yisrael? The place Moshe and Aaron didn't get to go, that they dreamed of going. And you were walking there. Your feet were walking on the ground that Moshe and Aaron only dreamed of walking on. Why didn't you mention that? And Rav Lichtenstein said, I walked out of his office feeling like a beaten dog. He really just put him in his place. And he said to himself, never again am I going to walk out of Eretz Yisrael without that feeling, without that feeling of connectedness. And there is a uniqueness of Eretz Yisrael on a religious level, in terms of the mitzvah of Tfilas Ba'aretz, certainly, in terms of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, and the Ramban's view, in terms of not just the mitzvah of Tfilas Ba'aretz and the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, but every mitzvah, the Ramban writes, is a greater mitzvah in Eretz Yisrael than it is in Chutz La'aretz. Ramban is an even more striking formulation, for those who are familiar, where he calls the mitzvahs in Chutz La'aretz practice, like Allen Iverson, practice. An Eretz Yisrael, okay, a couple of people know what I'm talking about. An Eretz Yisrael is where it's real. And he said, Rav Huttner, when he would go to Eretz Yisrael on the plane, and he would put on tefillin, daven on the plane, shachris, and put on tefillin, he'd put on tefillin again when he got to Eretz Yisrael that day, because the tefillin he put on that morning on the plane was chutz la'aretz tefillin. But now he wanted to do the mitzvah of Eretz Yisrael, dika tefillin. When I was in Yeshiva in Tiv Aryeh earlier this year, after Shachris, they have a Mishra Berurah shir. Rav Ami Merzel gives a Mishra Berurah shir, and I was listening to his Mishra Berurah shir, great shir, and he pointed out, he quoted Rav Nevinzal, who was sitting right there also, and he quoted Rav Nevinzal, that Rav Nevinzal also, whenever he flies to Eretz Yisrael, he puts on tefillin and chutzal, he'll put on tefillin again in Eretz Yisrael. Because it's a new mitzvah. So there is a significance in terms of on a religious level. There's also significance of aside from the mitzvahs, in addition to the mitzvahs, just being in the presence of the Shekhinah. The Rambam in Hilchos Tainios has two separate chapters about fasting when there's a lack of rain. One about when there's a lack of rain in Chutz La'aretz, and the other about fasting for a lack of rain in Eretz Yisrael. And Rav Soloveitchik points out in Shirim L'Zecher Av Amari, in his Yartzeit Shirim, the Gemara in Tainis Daf Yud says that the rest of the world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu provides rain through a malach. But in Eretz Yisrael, it's with the direct control of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So when there's a lack of rain in the rest of the world, we have to do Cheshbon HaNefesh, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is punishing us for some reason. But when there's a lack of rain in Eretz Yisrael, it's not just a punishment, it's a Hester Panim. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu hiding his face from us, because there's that direct connection to the Shekhinah. And there's a certain tsar that should be brought about as a result of that Hester Panim. And Rav Lichtenstein points out, and this I think he pointed out when he made Aliyah, he said, I think his last drasha in YU before he made Aliyah, he said, you go to a game, let's say, you're a sports fan. He would often give sports mashalim, which is interesting that he would do that. Right after he made Aliyah, Rav Soloveitchik used to send the sports section of the Boston newspapers to his grandchildren. He used to mail it to Eretz Yisrael. They didn't have internet, so like then 2 weeks later the mail would come, and they found out that the Red Sox won in June, and they were getting it in like July. Like, I guess that would excite them. But, he thought that was his way to connect to his grandchildren. Rav Soloveitchik could care less about what the Red Sox were doing, but it was a way to connect to his grandchildren at that point. Kids who make Aliyah, that if you ask children in America, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th grade children, what would be the biggest sacrifice of making Aliyah, very often they won't tell you their friends or their family. Or they'll tell you that the Yankees or the Mets, or that they're gonna miss sports. They're going to miss it, which is whatever. It's a whole separate drasha that, in terms of the role it plays in our lives. But he would use sports mashalim sometimes, and I totally forgot what sports mashalim was about to say. Yeah, he Oh yeah, he said, the mashal said, you go to a game and you could be a super fan, you could be fireman Ed at the at the Jets game, and you are the number one fan, but you know what? You're not even as chashuv as the third string cornerback, because you're not a player. You never make it onto the field. And someone who makes it onto the field, even if you have to be a third string cornerback, is better than being the greatest fan in the stands. And Rav Lichtenstein said this when he made Aliyah. He said, when you're in Eretz Yisrael, you're on the playing field of the Jewish history and Jewish destiny. When you're in Chutz La'aretz, you're in the stands. You could be the greatest fan. You could be, you know, paint your chest and do whatever you want and scream and drink as many beers as you want. But you're not on the field. And being on the field, on the playing field of the Shechina, is a very important thing for a Jew. And he has more to say, but Rav Lichtenstein, I'll just skip a little bit to the end. And he says, you know, having this type of worldview where we value Eretz Yisrael so much, where it means so much to us, is not the easy way out. Because it means, for us who grew up in Chutz La'aretz, it means that our entire lives we're going to have to constantly be asking ourselves whether we're in the right place, if we're doing the right thing. It's going to create a certain struggle. It would be much easier to take the mahalich of Krumah Medina, and you know, not have to worry about it, not think about it, whatever, wherever I'm most comfortable and whatever. It's much easier because then there's no struggle. But a life without struggle is not necessarily the life that our HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to live. A certain life of tension is okay. We're allowed to live with that tension. I think this is something that Rav Lichtenstein, again, projecting, because I never heard him, I never had any connection with him really directly, but I think this is something that he got from his Rebbeim. And it's important to note, even though everyone says the Rav was his Rebbe, the Rav was his father-in-law. When he refers to Mori Varabi, he rarely is referring to the Rav. He refers to the Rav as Mori Chami. When he's referring to Mori Varabi, he's either referring to Rav Aaron Soloveitchik or to Rav Huttner. And both of them had, and all three of his Rebbeim, really, Rav Soloveitchik, also had that dialectic always, that struggle, one side and the other side. And it's that was really a hallmark of Rav Lichtenstein's Hashkafa. So hopefully we got a little bit of a flavor of his Ahavas Eretz Yisrael, and hopefully it's something that we can incorporate into our own lives.